from HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 158, recorded live Wednesday, April 15th, 2009. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. And by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine, online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Joel Spolsky from Fog Creek Software.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm down here in New York on Wall Street, hanging out with Joel Spolsky at the Fog Creek Software. What are we on, 25th floor here?
Yep. World headquarters.
The world headquarters of Fog Creek. Mm-hmm. Thanks for taking the time to chat with me and inviting me down. And we had a lovely catered lunch, and I thought it was for me.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah.
No, we have lunch here every day. It's brought in at about noon.
Yeah.
By a pretty good caterer, so.
That's pretty sweet.
Happy.
So we were just sitting here chatting, and then I realized that, you know, shoot, we should just record this. So I figured we'd bust out the recording equipment and chat. You guys make FogBugs, and that's the product that you're known for, and you're coming out with FogBugs 7.
Yeah, FogBugs 7 should be going into beta on Friday for the very first couple of beta testers.
Cool. Friday will probably be the day that this podcast will go up, so that'll be today.
Okay.
So congratulations on the release of...
Send me, if you're a FogBugs user and you want to try out the early versions of the beta, just Twitter me at Spolsky.
Cool. A couple of years ago, I was reading about how you guys wrote this in the language that you wrote, and I thought that was really interesting because originally this was in VBScript.
Yeah, I mean, FogBugs has been around for absolute ages, and in fact, the very first early version, I mean, it's all been rewritten, but very, very early versions I wrote just to learn VBScript when it first came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was a window of opportunity there. I mean, this is before Java, this is before anything, when VBScript was just about the only reasonable Turing complete language you could find to run on a web server.
And this was like, you didn't want to do it in C++.
Right.
Yeah.
So
you did this in VBScript. So this was ASP, classic ASP.
Classic ASP, yeah.
All and, one file, master.asp.
No, we had a lot of little files that were all included in one big file, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But you wanted it to be cross-platform. That was really important.
The first problem that we had, I mean, we had this big code base in VBScript that we had modified. It was very clean. It was actually astonishingly clean, elegant, well-structured code that was... very, very functional. And the first problem that we had was customers asking to be able to run this on Unix. The only solution for running VBScript on Unix was something called ChiliSoft, which was $1,000 per server, and that was kind of expensive, and we couldn't get anybody to go for that. And so what we did is we took a summer intern and said, here, write a VBScript to PHP compiler. So this is a classic compiler. It's not a translator. It had a lexer and a parser and a code generator, and the code generator generated PHP given VBScript.
Why would you call it? Why not? Why is that not a translator?
I get into debates.
No, I'm not trying to debate. I'm just curious.
All the time. No, I know. A compiler and a translator are basically the same word.
Okay.
Compiler. People sometimes think of a compiler as being the thing which generates machine language or something, but that's actually not true. It very rarely does. A compiler generally generates some other language. It may or may not be human readable. The old compilers generated assembler, which was human readable. The first C++ compilers generated C, just because it was easier. And then they had all the existing C compilers available to get into assembler. There was no reason to take that extra step. And we took that inspiration of the early C++ compilers, which were called CFront, the first AT&T C++ compiler. We took that inspiration to say, well, let's make a compiler, and instead of going to the trouble of generating something which can be run at the machine level, let's just generate PHP.
And you didn't so you didn't do this as a translator in the sense of it wasn't a simple search and replace operation.
Right.
It's brought in the syntax tree and emitted another syntax tree.
Exactly. And it basically did true lexing and parsing as opposed to just some fancy regular expressions.
So then at this point, they're putting up PHP for the Unix version, and they're using the standard VBScript on
Windows.
And this goes on for a number of versions, and people are happy, and everyone is
thrilled. Not so happy. The PHP, I mean, PHP is not a good language, Scott. I hate to say this.
Really? Oh, my God. The world is going to explode, because isn't Facebook the operating system for the internet running entirely on PHP?
Maybe it is. You know, it is possible to, you know what, good programmers can write good, clean code in any language, no matter how bad it is. Uh-huh. But there were just difficulties. The PHP version always had issues. New versions of PHP would come out with incompatibilities. There were just sort of PHP never had good Unicode support. It was never, they never really solved that problem correctly. Mm-hmm. All kinds of issues around the way that references worked and passing a reference into a function, and just all that kind of stuff was obviously invented by somebody that didn't have a lot of computer language experience. And so there's just some fundamental mistakes.
Okay, so this is pre-PHP 5, and you're not enjoying yourself at this point.
Not enjoying ourselves.
Okay.
And to this day, we don't enjoy our PHP port. And so
it still exists, though.
Well, I mean, Fogbook 6, which is our current shipping version,
is
PHP, yeah.
Oh, so wow.
It's at the point where we're still releasing patches every once in a while in Fogbook 6.
Okay. And is that going to stop now? Is that dead?
Well, that's dead for the Fogbook 6 train of thought. What we did with Fogbook 7... is almost a complete rewrite of the compiler into a thing called Wasabi. Wasabi, the current version of Wasabi, takes a version of VBScript, which has added a lot of features. We've added a lot of features to the input language, the language that we compile. And just to give you an idea of some of those features, there are all these basically modern programming language features that are just starting to show up in C#. So some of them are like convenience features, like the ability to have a string that spans multiple lines. You know, like a really long string using the triple quotes. Some of them are, and that's a simple kind of convenience feature. Some of them are necessary because we now generate real CLR. So we're now a .NET language. Wasabi is a .NET language, effectively. And
so to be clear, you emit assemblies that contain intermediate language, and no one needs to know that.
Right.
And it just works, and it runs inside of CLR.
And it runs inside of CLR, either on... either regular IIS or the Unix version will run on mono. And and then we have access. We're just a first-class .NET language. We can link with C# or Iron Python.
Oh, really? So you can call other people's things. You really are first-class.
Yep.
And do you have references to other assemblies that are not written in Wasabi?
Yes, Fogbook 7 will. Fogbook 7 has a plugin architecture. You can write plugins in any .NET language.
So let me kind of take a small tangent. I want to come back to this, but my first kind of like visceral reaction is, but you make bug tracking software. Why?
Yeah.
Why is there, there's 6 billion people on the planet, some number of them are programmers, none of them had a solution for you, so your bug tracking software company wrote a new language.
Well, I wouldn't say it's a new language. I mean, we have a specific set of constraints that not a lot of other people do. Number one constraint was existing legacy code base that worked, that was debugged in VBScript. And VBScript is a bad language to program in. It's missing a bunch of stuff, but we added it. The truth is, I think a lot of the fundamental reaction, I mean, there was a lot of reaction against Wasabi saying, you know, WTF, why are you guys writing a compiler? And I think that fundamentally comes from the fact that a lot of programmers, especially a lot of, I won't use nasty terms. Well, let's just say a lot of beginning to intermediate programmers might think that there's something magical about a compiler, that this is too hard for them to do, that a compiler is like an operating system. It's for the gods of Redmond, Washington to create and maybe like a couple of geniuses that work for Google. But this is not code that I could ever write because it's something magical and incredible and mysterious, and it's like creating atoms. You need a sub.
I remember
my
compiler class was a 300 level class.
Yeah, it's 300 level. And so anybody that's learned how to program Java at the Java in 21 Days course at the Airport Marriott, or who basically learned how to program by downloading assorted JavaScript from websites in the early .com boom, might think that a compiler is something that they would have no idea how to ever go about doing that. But anybody that's taken the compiler course knows that it's a one semester project, and so,
and you had an intern do it.
Yeah, we had an intern do it. Later, we had a full-time employee who worked on it. But I mean, we know that it's a matter of a couple of months.
So
to
then,
so
you're answering my kind of like, and you're building a compiler with, well, it's just not that big of a deal to build a compiler.
Correct.
We had a great code base of input.
Yep.
Your input was really a domain-specific language at this point. I mean, you call it Wasabi, but it's Fogbug's VBScript.
Essentially.
And it was, you had a large existing DSL. Mm-hmm. Why not exploit that?
It was easier for us to do that than to port. I mean, we just sat there and made a decision. Do we write this compiler,
mm-hmm.
or do we port all of our existing code?
Right, write it to VB under MVC.
Right. Let's say, yeah.
Huh.
And this was, we just thought this was an easier way to do it and would leave us in control in a way that, and I mean, we have, Wasabi is a better language than either VB or C# for our needs, both in the sense that it is guaranteed to correctly compile our existing code,
right.
but also in the sense that we've added features to it that like, for example, type inference, a complete type inference system that figures out the type of everything without our having to declare them.
Hmm.
And it works, you know, it's better than the type inference that's in C# because it works across parameters and all that kind of stuff. It's the kind of thing that modern programming languages coming out of academia, by modern I mean 1990 mm-hmm. era, Haskell, okay. ML, all have this type inference.
So playing devil's advocate a little bit,
yeah.
Could one read into what you're saying and they, let's say that someone's listening to this podcast and in their mind, yeah, maybe there's two or three people who are listening and they're thinking, wow, Spolsky's like, blah, 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 I'm smarter than Anders.
No.
Blah, blah, blah.
No, I'm not.
Modern programming languages.
And Jacob, the people that worked on the compiler.
But you know what I'm saying?
I'm not, yeah.
Someone could be hearing this saying, wow, what arrogance to go and write a new language.
Yeah.
Do you look at it that way?
No.
No. And why
Plus,
don't you...
don't forget, I don't think anybody else in the world should use Wasabi. Otherwise, we would open source it.
That's exactly what my next question was, because and why am I not writing Wasabi?
Right, unless you have a body of code in VBScript that happens to use the same subset of VBScript as Fogbugs does,
mm-hmm.
This is probably not the ideal language for you. It's not the world's greatest.
If somebody
language.
Does, then I suppose they'll call you, and you'll license it to them or whatever.
If they want. But what they'll discover...
There's
quickly,
a lot of people out there with a lot of code
yeah.
in... VBScript,
VBScript,
who would very much
what we thought about
they're
that
probably
is,
calling ADO and doing random...
Well, that's the thing. We use, for example, we use probably 5% of what ADO makes available. And if somebody uses a different 5%, we've never bothered implementing that. So there's a bunch of stuff where, like I say, there's only one program that we have to compile with Wasabi, and that makes it a very specific kind of compiler. And to actually make it something that could take any arbitrary VBScript that anybody's written in the world.
See, that's really interesting when you said that you wrote a compiler that compiles not just to, it compiles one language, but it really compiles to one program. So uh-huh. if they're interested in compiling Fogbugs, then this is the language for them.
Exactly. And in fact, they'll get a free copy of the compiler when they buy Fogbugs. It'll be there in the accessories directory so they can compile Fogbugs.
Really?
Yeah, we ship with source.
Now, when someone creates a language, even a language that compiles one program, there's usually things like debugging and debug stacks. And
yeah, Visual Studio.
Really?
Yeah.
So it figures out everything for you and
yep.
you're able to get...
F10.
Really?
F11,
the
yeah.
stack mm-hmm. trace looks like... It points to the right line and says, yeah, everything's cool.
It's, I don't want to say it's like the world's best debugging environment, but it's definitely better than printf debugging.
Yeah. So it's not, you're not doing the old style, got
no.
here.
Yeah.
Got here no. debugging.
Now, there are a couple of cases. The truth is that the dev team here, if they could, would always write new code, would always rather write new code in C#. Mm-hmm. And so, Fogbug 7 has a big plugin architecture. The plugin architecture can take plugins written in any .NET language.
Ah.
And so we tend to write, if we can write a new feature by making it a plugin, we will do that, and then we'll be able to use C# and we'll get all the benefits of all those tools. I think somebody's written a couple of examples in Iron Python too, actually, of plugins.
Mm-hmm. So before you had .aspx, I mean, you had .asp mm-hmm. files.
Yep.
And I know how that entry point into IIS works and how
yeah.
you get a hold of the request object and response object and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
Now, are you an HTTP handler? I mean, how do you get into, what's your relationship with IIS?
I'm pretty sure, don't know.
Okay.
Sorry.
So there's some, but you're a full class .NET language, so you must be in there with.
I think it's still like the kind of one entry point, like where you just have one big,
yeah.
gigantic monolithic blob of code that runs and a bunch of classes.
Uh-huh.
I think it's kind of the same.
Now, when did Fogbugs start?
We've been shipping Fogbugs since November 2000.
2000. Wow,
yeah.
So you're about the 10 years thing coming up
and, yeah.
Pretty soon here. And when did you start joelonsoftware.com?
A little bit before that, 1999, I think I had an article, and mostly uh-huh. in the summer of 2000 before I started Fog Creek.
And when did people find value in it?
Never. I don't think there's any value in it. Are you kidding?
I was giving a talk at DevScovery just a little while ago here, and as one of the people said, well, why bother writing a blog? And I said, mm-hmm. well, you know, because I can go back and Google myself later. And
yeah,
I just went back to September of 2002 when I started it, and
right.
looked at the first post while we were there on stage, and it said, well, it looks like I'm blogging. We'll see how long this lasts.
That's everybody's first and most people's last post.
Yeah, a lot of people's last.
You know, a lot of people though. Blog. It's interesting to see some of the classic bloggers. The shape their blogs take make it clear why they're blogging. So, for example, Dave Weiner every once in a while will have a post where he says, "This is not going to be interesting to anybody. I'm just posting this so that I can find it in the future."
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, there was a point in, I would say, 2001, 2002, when Google got so good at finding things that everybody started to learn that stuff on the internet could be found, whereas they used to have an assumption that it couldn't. So, for example, until then, everybody had 4,000 bookmarks because they wanted to be able to get back to the Microsoft homepage again because they didn't know how, and they had to make a bookmark to the Microsoft homepage so they could find it.
On their own site.
Yeah.
Because everyone's own site became their homepage, right?
Their bookmarks, which was actually the bookmarks in the original version of Netscape. The bookmarks was an HTML file, actually. Mm-hmm. You could make that your homepage. But as soon as people discovered that you could trust Google to find things for you again, they started putting stuff out there simply so that they could find it again. And so a lot of programmers, that's what their blogs are just a lot of, okay, I know I'm going to need this again. And there's definitely posts like that of that form on Dolan Software. There are other kind of bloggers. I think of like Raymond Chen is the great example.
Oh, yeah.
Was one of, besides the fact that, you know, he just has brilliant and interesting things to say and almost everything he posts is sort of fun and interesting. But that his titles are almost always questions, and his post is an answer to that question. And you can tell that from the beginning he was conscientious that what he wanted to do is be the canonical answer to a question for a particular narrow, niche question about the Win32 API that he happened to know the answer to.
You know, in the talk I gave on social networking today, I said that, you know, you'll start blogging, and you know, I said everyone here should have a blog, and some people said, yes, I dedicate myself, I will get a blog. And I said, all right, well, you're going to blog in a vacuum for a year, and no one is going to read anything that you've ever written, and no one's going to care, and you're going to feel bad about that. And then one day, you'll write a post that'll be the post you become known for.
Yeah.
And then I asked John Robbins, who was there, I said, you, John, what is the post that everyone, and he says, how to install Vista 64 on MacBook Pros.
Yep.
Right?
Well, Scott, what was yours?
Exactly. Direct question and direct answer.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And not in any way what he was interested in blogging about.
No.
But he just happened to answer a question, and his post became the kind of canonical answer to something, right?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was a tools list that I wrote. It was Scott's, you know, ultimate tools list.
Oh, cool.
And then that just became like the thing. So every year, everyone wants. And actually, now this is the first year that I've skipped a year. I didn't do it last year, and now I'm getting complaints.
Right.
Where's this year's tool list?
Yeah, mine is probably that article about Unicode, although I had readers before that, but still probably the number one post on my site in terms of getting traffic is that little tutorial about Unicode that I wrote.
And it had kind of a, what we would call today, kind of a classic link bait title because it was so declarative. What every developer absolute minimum, no excuses.
Right.
I mean, it almost, the title just calls you an idiot and begs you to read it. And it was a great post, and that is to this day the kind of the canonical.
Right.
Were you worried that it wasn't correct? Were there any errors in it?
No, I was pretty sure it was reasonably correct.
Yeah.
What I was worried about at the time I was writing it is that there were 9 million other issues in internationalization, and the people that tend to be concerned about internationalization, nationalization, localization, etc., all tend to be monumentally nitpicky. And I thought that I would start to get long letters about how I hadn't said anything about how when you translate to German, all the dialogue boxes, you'll have to, all the words will get longer and you'll need to leave space for, and I didn't say anything about that. And I didn't talk about month, date, order.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't supposed to be the canonical.
No, it was about character sets.
Exactly.
Unicode. And it was this thing. And it was, what was interesting is that, so many people to this day don't know that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I read a book by Michael Kaplan, who now works at Microsoft.
Love Michael Kaplan.
Yeah.
Great guy. He has a really great blog called Sorting It Out.
Right. Also, a lot of stuff about character sets and localization, especially around character sets. He wrote a book called I think it was called Internationalization with Visual Basic, that I actually used to try to get an early version of CityDesk working with some reasonable Unicode level support. And that's how I kind of learned this stuff, because he just finally, you know, he explained it in a way that made sense to me for the first time. Nobody had ever tried to do that before.
Mm-hmm. And was that when that post happened? Was that when kind of what Chris Sells calls obscurely famous began?
No, I think I was sort of, I mean, there are a lot of other posts that I've written on Dolan Software that have gotten linked to by the people that read Dolan Software.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing special about that post in terms of the traffic that generated. The point that generated the most traffic was how Microsoft lost the API war. which got, you know, a monumental amount of attention, including a lot of internal attention at Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've been told that it was, you know, I think that was the Longhorn reset.
A couple of years ago.
Yeah. Was basically in some way inspired by some of the things that I mentioned there.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't want to take credit for that. That's going way too far. But there were conversations inside Microsoft that were instigated by this, how Microsoft lost the API war.
Do you know how to make the possible out of the impossible? Well, the .NET ninjas at Telerik do. They just released a huge pack of web controls all built on top of ASP.NET Ajax that'll help you build impossibly fast and interactive applications in no time at all. They've made the impossible possible in desktop development. If you think you can't have a carousel component in WinForms, well, you can. Their Windows Forms suite features a super powerful grid view control and 32 other crazy desktop components that'll give you dazzling WPF-like features, but in WinForms. They do the same thing in reporting solutions with a new design surface like nothing else. Looks just like graph paper. Gives you advanced page layout capabilities. Makes it feel more like a graphic design software than a reporting solution. Go check them out at Telerik.com and be a .NET ninja. And thanks for listening. It's amazing how bloggers can affect things inside of Microsoft. A really great blogger that I really enjoy that I don't think enough people read is a guy named Long Zheng. He's a guy out of Australia, and he has a blog called I Started Something.
Oh, yeah.
And it is just such a thoughtfully written blog. And he doesn't just complain, which a lot of bloggers do, but he also takes action.
Right.
So, for example, he doesn't like UI inconsistency.
Uh-huh.
So rather than complaining about it, and he actually made a website that's a community site that does nothing but collect screenshots of dialogues with inconsistencies so that people can document and then up-mod or down-mod them.
Mm-hmm.
It's the stack. This was done a couple of years ago, but it's kind of the Stack Overflow for one thing, UI inconsistencies.
Yep, yep.
He's got one for Windows 7,
cool.
One for Vista, and one for Mac OS 10.
Vista was really bad.
Yeah, and that took a lot of attention internally at Microsoft. People were like, oh, wow, look at this, a screenshot, nice bug report. I mean, it was, you know, bug tracking for that kind of stuff. I think that I don't enjoy reading complainer blogs as much as I enjoy.
No, you're right. I don't, because if you're just complaining, then it's like, yeah, I know, cell phone companies suck.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry you had a bad experience with your cell phone company, but am I really going to continue to read these until the end of time?
Exactly.
And if everybody's going to have a blog, are we all going to write the same post about the bad thing that AT&T did to you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, at some point, that's not necessarily the most productive.
So how much are you blogging now? You do once a week or?
No, not even. I hardly ever have time to blog anymore. And,
really?
And I've also kind of run out of things to say, because a lot of what I was writing in the early days was, you know, accumulated knowledge of a couple of decades of working in software. And once I had gotten the main points out that I wanted to get out, you know, I try to maintain the same level filter that I always had. If a post is not, you know, if it's not, you know, relatively novel and I feel like I have a kind of an interesting thing on it and people seem to be missing the point, I won't write it. And one thing that has happened is there's so many other good bloggers out there now that I don't have to be the one to write those posts.
It is a little intimidating, though, I must say. Like Jeff Atwood has, there's a cadence to his blogging, just once a day.
Yeah.
And even though sometimes I'll go, come on, Jeff. It was Tuesday. That was a crappy post. You just threw that one away. It's just that every weekday there's a good post from Jeff. Now, a number of years ago, he posted that you had jumped the shark.
And I think that's probably still one of the top Google hits
now,
on my
name. For those of us who are not necessarily from the U.S. who are listening to this podcast or who may not speak English, to jump the shark is actually a reference to an episode of the American sitcom Happy Days, when somewhere in the fourth or fifth season, they decided to set up a very silly spectacle where the Fonz would jump a shark on a pair of skis.
Right.
And it was a ridiculous, silly stunt.
To try to get viewers in a fading television.
In a fading television show. Yeah. So then to jump the shark became the mark of when something that you once loved has finally peaked and is now heading downhill.
Right.
So Jeff said in a very public post dedicated to Joel Spolsky, jump the shark. We once loved him, and now it's over. Let us all watch him go down in flames.
Okay.
Now you guys are like hanging out all together. You got a podcast you're going to record in an hour, and you're in a business venture.
Yeah.
If I insult you in a Can we hang out more if I blog mean things
Scott,
about
I'll
you?
Hang out with you whether or not you insult me, but go ahead.
How in the world did that turn into Fast Friends?
Well, actually, I didn't know about that post until I'd already signed on the contract.
Weren't you insulted?
No, I'm not really insulted by thoughtless, meaningless nonsense. Like, no.
So you didn't know about that? It wasn't like on your radar?
No, I did know about that. I thought that Jeff was a good blogger and an important blogger, and so that's kind of more important to me than the fact that he happened to insult me once.
He did the same thing to Paul Graham, and now they hang out.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He said, go search for his blog for Paul Graham, and he went on about how he sucks, and now Jeff and Paul talk. So you know, I think it's a great way to meet famous people.
Something that's kind of actually important if you're a blogger, I might want to tell people, is that as an early blogger, your one way which you can gain fame is by trying to take down people who were more mighty than you.
Mm-hmm.
So I can write a post saying how Microsoft lost the API war because Microsoft is mightier than I am, and you know, I can do that. On the other hand, now that I've got Fog Creek Software, we have 25 employees, we're making millions of dollars a year, we're highly profitable, we have this big, beautiful office, and I have a blog that's read by a million people, for me to attack some blogger, say, that only has 200,000 readers instead of a million readers would be cruel. It would just be...
Yeah, yeah.
And whatever point you are in the scale, you're allowed to poke at the people that are above you, but it's not very nice. It's just not polite, really, to attack the people that are weaker and smaller than you. It's just not basic manners, I think.
In some extent.
And so, whereas I used to get a lot of joy out of writing a blog post making fun of some startup with a ridiculously idiotic idea, because nobody knew who I was, and their idea was ridiculous and
now
idiotic.
It's mean.
Now I sort of feel bad. I'm not going to attack two guys working on a little Y Combinator startup that have a ridiculous, stupid idea.
Yeah,
they don't need to be attacked by me. That's just like beating up little kids in the playground.
So speaking of two guys working on a ridiculous startup with a stupid idea.
Yeah,
Stack Overflow.
Yeah, exactly. Four guys though.
Yeah. So, you and Jeff are partners in this Stack Overflow thing, and it's like a rocket. I went on compete.com, and the traffic is looking great.
Yeah, their numbers are terrible. We don't hesitate to publicize their numbers, but they're substantially higher than what compete.com shows by orders of magnitude.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So compete is wrong.
Yeah. We
said like 14 million page views last month.
Yeah, that's our number. That's not compete's number.
Oh, I thought compete said that.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know how they...
There's all these different things like Compete and Netcraft and Alexa. Everybody wants to know what the hot numbers are.
Yeah, they're all wrong, and they're all using Internet Explorer plugins that no programmer has. So
that explains why they would be so low.
Right. The current numbers are about, 14 million pages a month, 6 million visitors a month, 3 million unique visitors a month. That pretty much...
So 3 million unique individual human beings.
Well, you know, the way uniques is defined is... We try to set a cookie, and if the cookie's still there, we continue to be.
Yeah.
You continue.
So that's a lot of people.
Some people clear their cookies.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah.
And the thing I think
that is a lot, especially, I mean, the best estimates I've heard of how many programmers there are 2 to 4 million. So.
In the 2 to 4 million programmers? Nonsense. I think you're insane. No, I would totally disagree with that. That's a really interesting question. We should have some audience participation if we had an audience.
There is.
I suspect there are probably 3 million C# developers. Alone in the world.
Well,
I know for example, in Norway.
How many programmers, what percentage of programmers do you think are in the United States? Because there is U.S. Department of Labor.
Yeah, that's a good question. Let me put it this way. In Norway, there's like what? How many people in Norway? 6 million people?
Yeah.
Someone told me that in Norway, there are 30,000 .NET developers.
Okay, well, we can't extrapolate from Norway.
We can't extract from Norway.
But what we can
they're very
do is,
smart in Norway.
I believe, here's where I get that. The Department of Labor.
Okay.
Can I Google this now?
He's going to Google now, and I'm going to talk while he Googles. So he's going over to Google now. He's not using Stack Overflow to answer this question, which I think is a little sad.
No, you know what? It will. It'll come up with the Stack Overflow. It'll be on the first
really?
Page.
He's going to be on the first page. So, yeah, let me think. He says 3 million programmers in the entire world. I think it's more like 30 or 40 million. That's a lot.
How many programmers
in the world
are there in the world? This is actually going to be kind of illustrative. So
Google Answers. How many programmers are there?
Yeah, Google Answers. That's actually
no answer. All right, okay. What's the next one? How many programmers?
Yahoo Answers. And this is like there are 6 billion people in the world times 1%.
Right. And this is about the same as trying to figure out how many aliens there are in the universe because you just have to go and and guess
absolutely.
How many grains.
All right, here's
of
the
sand.
Stack Overflow.
All right, so, yeah, so Stack Overflow shows up, and what do we see?
Well, they're also, this guy is guessing 12 million, but he's saying 1% of people with computers or something. That's kind of ridiculous.
Oh, that's interesting, though. 1% of people with computers?
Oh, wow.
But that was marked.
Oh, here we are. Here's the U.S. government. 3.1 million Americans.
Okay, here we go.
So that's a real statistic. Now the next thing, which we might have a statistic.
Oh, well.
What percentage of Microsoft developer product tools revenue comes from outside the United States?
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm betting it's about 50-50.
Okay, so there's 300 million.
I would say 6 million.
There's 300 million Americans. That's counting old people and babies.
3 million Americans.
3 million of them.
No.
Oh. No, 300 million Americans.
Yeah.
There's no babies or old people that program. And with 3 million of them, 1% of Americans are programmers.
Okay.
So then you figure, you can't say 6 billion because not everyone's doing this kind of stuff.
No, there's no way that 1% of Chinese are programmers.
So 1% of computer users, then say.
No, I want to just say.
That's like 60 million people.
No. I don't believe so, because I think that America has more programmers per capita than
oh, I bet you if you took the G, what you should do is take the G20.
Okay.
Right? 1% of the total population of the G20.
I'm going to go by almost all software companies tend to report that 40 to 50% of their sales are in the United States.
Okay.
And these are.
And everyone else is outside.
Yeah.
Okay.
So basically.
So you're saying that times two.
Yeah. That's why I think it's that times two.
6 million programmers.
6 million programmers.
Okay. I don't know. And you're getting a chunk of them.
Half.
Yeah, I think that's a little high.
Yeah, it's probably high.
Yeah.
Well, we'll
but
see
still,
how high it goes, because
yeah, we'll see.
We're doubling every four months.
When you have a lot. Yeah, if you double, talk to me in 4 months, and if you have them all, then that'd be great. I think, really, the way that you know, and I mean you, I mean anyone knows, is when you can just mention it to anybody. And they go, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I mentioned Stack Overflow today, and about, I don't know, 30, 40% of the audience raised their hands.
That's about what we're seeing. That's what happened in the mix.
Right. And that doesn't mean that they're active users, but it means it's starting to get in their consciousness. They're starting to use it. They're starting to think about it.
Most people will discover it because it'll start to come up in Google search results.
Exactly.
And they won't even look at the name of the site until about the third time they've seen Stack Overflow.
Yeah.
And they start realizing they're getting better answers from Stack Overflow.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're doing the Google thing of reaching over three other sites to pick the fourth result.
Because they see the Stack Overflow site. Yeah, they want that one.
Yeah. And actually Google detects that and starts to.
Does it really?
Yeah, they start to twiddle. They'll twiddle what's on the homepage based on if they discover people reaching over another site.
Oh, and I've noticed that I get different results in Google whether I'm signed in or not.
Right.
So they know what I prefer to look at. All right, well, that was a big ego trip right there. But the Woo-hoo. Point is that you're starting to answer questions that people want to get answered. And it's kind of showing that the full text search indexing is just not the best way to get the answer to a question.
There's a general weakness with search engines that comes around in these sort of Q&A, experts answering questions kind of areas.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that they've been pretty weak, this is sort of my guess, is, there's a couple of things, but the main point is that these programming questions are very, very narrow. So a question on Stack Overflow that's popular will have 1,000 people look at it.
Okay.
Ever. So
yeah,
it's too narrow.
I thought was a little bit of a low.
Yeah.
A low. I mean, I asked a question and I figured just in like peripheral, kind of like collateral people looking at it, I get a couple of thousand. But it's really just a few hundred for very, very narrow questions.
And you'll get your answers. And they'll be voted up and the right ones will be voted up and you'll get a lot of people.
Yeah.
You'll get the right people.
But that aggregate number is way smaller than you would think given the quality of the answers.
Right. So now how many people are going to go make a link to your Stack Overflow question?
One.
Right. And it'll be from Twitter, so it'll be going through IS.gd.
One or two. You're absolutely right.
So
the URL shortening is a huge problem that we're not dealing with.
So PageRank does not work for these such narrow topics.
Mm.
Authority doesn't work because authority is like, well, is the site authoritative?
So just to make sure that the audience understands, when he's saying PageRank does not work, is that Google is fundamentally built on the idea that people will like your stuff and link to it.
Right.
And what he's saying is that a question is asked. How do I da-da-da the XML serializer?
Yeah.
And the answer comes down. You do it like this, and it's correct and it's perfect,
mm-hmm.
but no one ever links to it.
Right. So Google has no way of knowing that that's the best answer.
Exactly.
Right. And so that's the first problem. The second problem is think of all the different ways you could phrase that question.
Mm-hmm.
And so whatever incoming traffic there might be from the search engines to this question gets fragmented across a much larger spectrum of possible ways of phrasing this question.
And interestingly, that issue of phrasing the question is where I think everyone in the audience here will understand, I'm gesturing towards the empty cafeteria to my right. Everyone in the audience, that guy over there who's getting tea knows that they are probably, just by virtue of the fact that they're listening to this show, the guy who can Google best, or gal who can Google best. And we all have that situation where a friend says, man, I've Googled, my brain's out, I've been Googling for an hour, help me get the answer to this. And I look for it, and it's like the first hit. And then, oh, you're the Google master, baby. You're the Google master. No, I just know how to phrase things sufficiently vague that Google, you know, I pick the right two words.
You pick the right two keywords that you know are going to be in the answer.
That's a huge problem.
Yep.
Because I don't know what is causing me to answer the right.
Think of their entire classes of things that cause problems for Google on searching for specifically programmer-related questions. Mm-hmm. One great one is, let's say that you're searching for a question related to VB6 as opposed to VB.net. Just as a typical example.
Anything old and you're screwed.
Yeah, anything old and you're screwed, and anything new and you're screwed. For example, a big common complaint today, these days, and it'll eventually work itself out of the system, but right now, if you search for ASP.net MVC things on Google, you wind up getting a lot of stuff about early betas that are either no longer true or no longer correct
because
stuff changed.
And we were trying to put a lot of really good information out really fast to make people feel good, and but now they're finding all sorts of code that doesn't compile.
Right, right. And not only that, that stuff, because there's no page rank, because Google can't look at page rank because there's not enough people linking to these things, it looks at authority and it uses other measures of authority, like the older the link, the more authoritative it is, because Google will generally prefer a link that hangs around for a long time rather than something ephemeral. And that means that it is actually a constitutional problem of search engines that if something is wrong is out there, it's going to continue to be pointed to by search engines. So that's why we knew that Stack Overflow, when we designed Stack Overflow, we said, first of all, it has to have voting because we got to have 10 experts on the subject get together and just decide what's important. And that they have to use that gesture rather than the gesture of making a link from their blog, because that's the only way
This helps you prioritize your search, but how do you tell Google?
Well, here's the thing. When we have, we're prioritizing the answers. So as long as Google finds us as the question, and Stack Overflow has authority because programmers around the world link to it from their blogs to this top-level domain, then at least Stack Overflow will have a high page rank, and our version of the question will be bumped above, let's say, an old Usenet version of that question. And if that happens, once you get into our question, now there are two reasons why our answers are going to be better. One is that the answers are constantly going to be resorted and voted upon, so whatever is the best answer will be at the top. You don't have to search through all the answers.
Right.
You at least have a place to look to find what the best answer is that's the consensus of the people that have looked at this narrow question, the 100 people that have participated in this narrow question. And secondly, it's a wiki. So if it is wrong, or if it is out of date, or it is obsolete, somebody's going to hit the edit button and fix it, and make that code compile. And so these old established Stack Overflow topics that have lots of Google karma can continue to come up number one in the search results, and yet they can change as the technology changes. One great example is, think about how many times you've seen an answer to a question that has come up, you know, when you're searching for a programming question, and it's got, you know, a cross-site scripting vulnerability in the answer, or it's a gigantic SQL injection problem.
Right. It should not exist.
It's going to cause somebody to cut and paste code that's going to be a security problem.
Right.
You can't do anything about it. There's no edit button on most of these sites. And on Stack Overflow, you'd hit the edit button and say, warning, cross-site scripting vulnerability.
Yeah.
Or do not actually run this code. Because you're just concatenating together a SQL string. I think probably about half of the books that have been published about web programming concatenate strings that they then pass off to a SQL server.
Oh, yeah.
And there's, you know, the strings coming from the user.
Yeah, so, I had a buddy of mine is working on some analysis software that looks at logs, and he found that there was a botnet that keeps attacking my blog, and it's like the same 300 or 400 IP addresses doing the same 3 or 4 things where they try to drop tables the end of my blog.
Just for fun.
Yeah, just for fun. So this thing about where Google is grabbing, and where any, I guess I'm saying Google, I mean any generic search engine is getting their data. PageRank doesn't work anymore. Mm-hmm. With Twitter, I am surprised how often I see Stack Overflow appear in a Google result. I cannot remember the time when I've ever seen a result from Twitter show up as the result of a search. Even if I was really specific.
It actually can't. That's the reason why. That's the only model for Twitter, which is that
Twitter permalinks don't show up in Google results?
Twitter, unless somebody links to it from a blog, in which case it might. But Google can't just search all Twitter because they don't have the feed.
Which is why they're looking at buying them.
They call it the fire hose version of Twitter, which only is only available to search.twitter.com right now, maybe one or two other companies.
And then, of course, we have the URL shortening issue, which is if you're on Twitter, you're trying to fit everything into a tiny, tiny, you only have 140 characters, so then you're going to go and use like is.gd.
Yep.
And then you, then the, again, PageRank falls down.
Right.
This seems like a huge, huge problem. And I don't know if Twitter being bought by Google is just the start of that.
I would assume that there is somebody at Google working on it. I mean, that's not a hard problem for Google.
But the URL shortening means that they're going to have to find, you know, the APIs for expansion and for all of these different things, follow them around.
Yeah, not so hard.
You don't think it's a big deal?
No. I'm sure they probably have already done half of this. Sure.
I have a lot of confidence that Google's just, they got a smart PhD working on that right now.
You don't need a smart PhD. You need a table. And the first column is the name of the domain name of the URL shortening service. And the second column is, three columns. The second column tells you how to construct a query to the URL shortening service. Yeah, yeah. The third column is a regex that tells you how to get the correct URL out of the result.
Or you just follow
it. It's a 301 result, actually.
Or you just visit it and see what happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the kind of thing that they have to keep up with all kinds of things all the time.
It sure feels like Google slowed down a little bit on the blog search stuff because I'm finding that I used to just search Google.
Yeah.
And now I search Google, search.twitter.com, and Stack Overflow when I want the answer to something. Mm-hmm. And I'm also finding that, more because Twitter prioritizes results in terms of time.
Right.
I literally can't find anything that's older than a couple of days.
No, and I think Twitter, I don't even know if that stuff...
People are using it as a link sharing service, though. Right. Hey, check this out, link. You know, it's interesting, the whole kind of check this out, link.
Yeah.
That's how email, it first was like email, right? Hey, check this out, link. And then it became people who do throwaway blog posts.
Right.
Right, here, check this out. And then no one uses Delicious. I did the stats, and delicious.com, which is a fantastic social bookmarking service. Virtually no one uses it. It has very, very small. The most alpha geeks use Delicious, and it's such an extraordinary service. So then now people are using, I know there's a Microsoft blogger named Elijah Manor, and all he does is Twitter, links, like every 20 minutes or so. Hey, check this out. Link and then hashtag, mm-hmm. which is great if I want a fire hose of links, but I want to know where those, I want to find them later.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't because he'll give me a keyword or two, a short URL, and it was just, it's like a firefly. It burst and it was gone.
Yeah. You have to, I mean, Twitter gives me a headache. Sometimes I feel like going to Twitter is seeing like a list of tweets that people have made, which are like, check this out or check that out. And sometimes you can't understand what's going on. You have to figure out who's.
And then you have to, this is the problem, and you have to reassemble the conversation yourself.
I can't stand it. Why don't people use Twitter? Stop it. Go away. You know what? It's just the downfall of discourse. It's just a bunch of people screaming.
Twitter is the downfall of discourse.
Yes.
I shall tweet that right now.
Yes,
my wife is getting into that kind of stuff.
You can put something on Twitter and you don't even have room to justify what you said. It's not even possible to make an argument on Twitter. All you can do is say your final conclusion, your opinion on the thing that just happened.
That's so funny because people are arguing on Twitter. They're using it like it's IRC with permalink.
But they're not. But yeah, it's a different kind of IRC where the people that you're talking to, you're not actually listening to them.
That's true.
You're not following because there isn't reciprocity with following, which there is on IRC.
Well, this is like me not listening to you right now because I'm Twittering. Twitter is the downfall of discourse, and I'm trying to remember how to spell. I'm doing this with one hand, though. Discourse, period, quote, at Spolsky. How did I spell discourse? Nope. I think I just made you... Spolsky. Enter. There we go. Now I feel complete. Now I put that out there.
Okay.
There's a funny Twitter question.
Now, the great thing is that I didn't have to back that up. You don't have to back that up. I don't have to back that up. People can argue with us, but there's no room.
Well, and there's no proof that you even said it, right? Just because I Twittered it doesn't mean it really happened. Oh, cool. Well, Joel, thanks so much for sitting down with me today and talking.
Sure,
I appreciate
fun.
It. It's great to have a tour of the place, and I hopefully I'll get to come and hang out with you again next time I'm in New York.
Cool, that'll be awesome. Thanks for having me on.
All right, this has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'll see you again next week.